You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's pod is James Cordova, who is a distinguished professor of psychology at Clark University. A leader in relationship research and couples therapy, he is the developer of the Marriage Checkup, an innovative approach to improving relationship health. Dr. Cordova is a longtime teacher of Zen meditation, and he has a new book. It's called The Mindful Path to Intimacy, Cultivating a Deeper Connection with Your Partner. Enjoy the pod. James Cordova, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I don't know how much you know about the field of improvisation. I'm going to assume not a ton. But in our work, we stress that it's a practice that requires you to be fiercely in the moment. And your overriding job is to save your partner, and their job is to save you. You also learn to see all obstacles as gifts, and you learn to play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. So after reading your book, it seems like this is very connected.
I hear a lot of resonance in that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's the reason the podcast exists, right? Is that improvisation is human being practice. And the skills of improvisation when you're making something out of nothing, it turns out, are pretty healthy ways of having relationships.
Right. Yeah. No, I was reading up a little bit about it when I was getting ready for this podcast and thinking something very similar. Like, there's just so much that's about like meeting the moment and just meeting it for what it is and moving forward, right?
Yeah. Regardless of whatever's happening. No judgment.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much I enjoyed in the book. In the introduction, you say, quote, "We can find ourselves at a place in our relationship when we're comfortable, but not close, as if we traded connection for stability." That rings very true from what I hear in a lot of my friends' relationships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, for me, it is the way in which I feel and I think I see in other relationships. It's how we resolve this porcupine's dilemma, mm-hmm. right? The fact that we are both sensitive and vulnerable and also prickly, mm-hmm. right? And just humans, right? So, and the closer that we get to each other, the more vulnerable we are to each other. And staying inside of that vulnerable space, is a practice, and it requires an incredible amount of skill, both to be able to navigate the ways in which we do these little, we create these little harms in our partner, you know, that are just like we're stepping on each other's toes. Sometimes it's not a big deal. Sometimes it's a bigger deal. And how we receive those little toe steps, right? Those little harms. And staying inside of Quill's distance, which is how I think of that intimate space, is so challenging that I think for many, if not most couples, the compromise that they make is to stay as close as they can, but just outside of Quill's distance, so that they're close but not too close. And then I think the side effect of that is everything looks like it ought to look, but we're still carrying a quality of loneliness in our relationship that we can't quite put our finger on why that is.
Early in the book, you mentioned something that really stuck with me, which is this idea that the problem is pain and that everyone is entering a relationship with a pain, and they might not even know how to articulate that particular pain. But the solution is not – the pain isn't going away.
Right.
So the solution isn't like, oh, fix your pain. It's like, I'm going to be present with your pain and you're going to be present with mine. We're going to screw up. But as long as we are, you know, focused on that North Star, you know, we got a really good chance of making this thing work.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the way that we think about intimacy is that it really is rooted in, it's a product of the vulnerability that we bring to the moment, the vulnerability that we bring into this relationship. And the sort of fundamental challenge of that is vulnerability never becomes invulnerability, mm-hmm. and vulnerability feels vulnerable, mm-hmm. right?
That's the rough part about that.
That's right, as it turns out, right? So, and what is it? It's vulnerability to pain, right? It's vulnerability to hurt. And of course we become the source in each other's lives of both, the person who we yearn to feel the safest with, mm-hmm. right? And also, this is the paradox of it, the person who is just by virtue of being so close to us, the person who's going to most frequently hurt us. In small ways, in medium-sized ways, sometimes in large ways, right? So we're navigating this really complex space when we talk about an intimate relationship, where we're trying to cultivate for each other a relationship in which both of us feel safe being our vulnerable, authentic selves, while at the same time we're constantly stepping on each other's toes.
Well, and that's the razor's edge, isn't it? Where you have to figure out, okay, what is a mistake, a minor hurt, and when is it, oh, someone is actually using our closeness to hurt me? Because I've been in both relationships, and gladly I'm in, you know, the better one now.
Yeah, good. Yeah. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. Congratulations. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
But we all move through those, right? Like you get to that one that feels like, oh, this one, by having, you know, learned through experience, right? And I think that that really is the key, that the you know, our instinct is to turn away from vulnerability, you know, to find ways to keep ourselves, well, if you're not going to keep me safe, then I'm going to keep myself safe, but I'm going to stay, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I think that that is an unfortunately common place that people find themselves in their relationships. But the key for me is that there is real strength in our capacity to maintain our vulnerability in a relationship. Because if I am committed to being my authentic vulnerable self in a relationship with you, I learn really quickly how capable you are of taking good and loving care of my vulnerability. If you are committed to being your vulnerable, authentic self with me, you're going to learn really quickly how capable I am of being careful and loving with your vulnerability. And if the answer is not very, then that's information that I get to use to make wise choices about whether to continue to be in what I hope to cultivate as a long-term intimate relationship.
And check me if I'm wrong. While I understand that the book is about romantic relationships, this doesn't apply just to romantic relationships.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. What we know from what gobs of research is that the more deeply intimate relationships, the closer relationships that we have, the wider that network of closer relationships is, the healthier we are, the more resilient we are to all of the slings and arrows of what it's like to be a human being through, you know, illness, old age, right? The vagaries of life, right? So developing this quality of trusting relationship with many people is essential to our emotional and psychological health.
The reason I brought that up, literally a half hour ago. I'm not feeling great today. Like, I'm feeling a little bit off. Mm-hmm. There's maybe allergies. I've got a little puppy at home, which is great, but it's hard work.
Yeah.
So lots going on. And I ran into a colleague I don't see often. I've known this person for probably 30 years. Mm. We've been in many situations together. Are we close? Like, we're very friendly. He's always someone I enjoyed. We kind of ran into each other. He had a little time, so we were chatting. And I'm like, how's the family? And he kind of went, yeah. And I'm like, what's up? And he's like, oh, my kid's having trouble. Mm. And I was like, yeah. I said, you know, I've been there. My son Nick is, you know, now 27. He had rough times in high school and grade school, mm-hmm. but he's doing well. I go, and we had a really good chat about it. And I think I made him feel a little bit better. You know what? Actually, though, it made me feel better.
Right.
And I think it was just like, we were just vulnerable with each other in mm-hmm. a way, and not trying to like, and what we both said is the worst thing about being a parent in these situations is you can't do anything.
Oh my God. Right. Yeah. Yep.
And I think if more of us did that with people who aren't even our close friends,
right,
it would solve a lot of the ills that seem to be plaguing us in our society.
Well, I love that story. And there's several things that I love about it. One, that, that your friend, and this is true for all of us, right? Like, our vulnerable selves are actually really obvious. We think that we're hiding them, but they're really obvious. And we get trained to pretend that we don't see each other. Mm-hmm. But you didn't do that, right? Mm-hmm. Your friend just sort of stuttered a little bit, just gave a little bit of like, meh, right? And you could have, and it would have been absolutely socially acceptable, maybe even more socially acceptable, to just pretend you didn't see that.
Yeah.
Right. And to move on with the more surface level conversation. But you didn't do that. Right. You saw him and you didn't pretend that you didn't see him. You, mm-hmm. you asked, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's up? Right. Yep. And that is such a crucial move, because that's that choice opportunity that we have over and over again to turn away or to turn toward, right? Mm-hmm. And just your choice in that microsecond to turn toward, resulted in something that was so much more meaningful, right? Yeah. Such a better way to spend that time.
Yeah, yeah. It's a virtue of age and things I've gone through. Mm. I don't want to have these, I love small conversations, but I want them to be smart and purposeful and meaningful.
Right. Right. I don't have time for the shallow ones. Right?
I literally, Dan Pink has this book on regret where he's like, count how many weekends you have left. And it's a very sobering thing to do because it's not that many. And when you do it, you're like, okay, so where am I putting my attention?
Yeah.
And this is so important in your book, because you say, quote, attention is the most basic form of love. Mm. Quote. Talk more about that.
Yeah, so this is there's several sources for this one. The one that I stole it from most directly is a Zen teacher called John Tarrant, and the our attention is always somewhere, but especially nowadays, you notice how scattered our attention can be, how challenging it can be to keep our attention on one thing, one person in particular. Folks are constantly distracted by their phones, looking past each other. I think a lot of us in conversations, one of the things that I'll ask some of the classes that I teach to do is like, next time you're out in a restaurant, in a cafe, like, just don't pretend you're not eavesdropping. Eavesdrop on purpose, right? And pay attention to how people are talking to each other. Mostly they're just taking turns talking about themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. They could be sitting at completely separate tables with completely different people and having exactly the same conversation. But what we find, especially, in our job, I imagine that this is true in your job as it, this part of your job, right? Like, yeah. Like interviewing people, like when you give people your full attention, they blossom, mm-hmm. right? Because we, so many of us are so hungry for somebody to give us their full attention. And we receive it as a kind of mattering, right? We receive it as being cared about. And I think especially in our families, in our intimate relationships, in our long-term romantic relationships, it becomes really easy because of things that we know about how our mind and perception work to start to really take each other's presence for granted. And even though we're spending time in the same house, maybe we're even spending time doing the same thing, we're not really paying attention to each other. And again, I think out of that sense that inattention is really, really perceived as disconnection. And of course, then the other side of that coin, that being met, being seen, being having somebody be curious about you to bring that full attention to you really feels like love.
Yeah. I think it's important to also note that you can be so smart about this stuff, but we're all going to do it. Like I have a terrific marriage. I really do. And it's people say that they like, no, but when I was reading this book and I'm talking to my wife, Anne, and I'm realizing like, oh no, my phone's, you know, I got to turn my phone over. I've got to stop. I got to just sit and listen. Mm-hmm. And I did that and it was great. Like she could feel it. I could feel it. But you know, we make this joke at Second City that we're like doctors who smoke. We'll go teach people how to do this stuff, you know? And so, but I don't know that there's any way around it because the other side of this is perfection, which doesn't exist.
Right. Right. Well, and so that in some ways, you know, Kelly, you're pointing at what is central to this book, right? Which is this practice, right? Mm-hmm. That as much as we think about meditation, mindfulness meditation, contemplative prayer as practices, right? This practice of dedicated loving attention, it's a practice, right? Yeah. And like a language or learning how to play a musical instrument or dance, you know, like you can fall out of practice, mm-hmm. right? And get rusty at it, or you can stay in practice, right? And the more you practice, the better you get at it. But it's not one of those things that's an achievement, right? Like,
yeah.
I got an A+ in listening and then I got to go on with the rest of my life and never really try anymore, right? I just get to live resting on my laurels. I think that's the thing that I really want to communicate to couples through my work, through this book, is that transforming the way we think about our relationships from something that you just achieve and then rest into, to something that is a daily, even moment by moment practice, has the value, the promise of being transformative, not just to the relationship as a whole, but to each moment that we have with each other.
So this morning, I woke up, we still get the newspapers. We get two, the New York Times and Chicago Tribune. I open the Chicago Tribune and I see my friend, in the paper. And I didn't know this. He wrote a book about his family business that he took over from his dad, and his dad died young. And I knew that. And I knew his dad actually quite well. But the book, the thing that sort of shocked me was, I guess his dad was an alcoholic. Mm. And not the easiest guy. Mm-hmm. My vision of this man is not that. Like it was a legendary figure. And mm-hmm. so I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know this. And you talk a lot in this book about how parenting affects us in terms of our attachment styles. Mm-hmm. And my friend wasn't trying to like get back at his dad. It was more of like, this is why I joined the church. This is why mm-hmm. I... Mm-hmm. don't drink. This is why, you know, that sort of thing. And so like, we don't have any say over that, how we're parented.
No,
but it's unavoidable, right? That it is going to imprint an attachment style on us.
Exactly.
How do you deal with that? Please tell me.
give me the 10 second answer. Right. Yeah.
I'll give you 20 seconds.
It's part of the same thing. It's a lifetime practice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and it is about attention. It is about mindfulness. It is about becoming more and more clear about ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of mindfulness practice in relationship to ourselves and to each other is really just about getting to know ourselves. And if you don't know what your attachment style is, then it is driving the bus, not you. Right? But if you start to get a feel for what your attachment style is, then you can start to do things on purpose to try to, on you know, with your own access to your own self-knowledge and your own wisdom, you can start doing things on purpose in relationship to try to cultivate a greater sense of security and intimacy. So, you know, our attachment style is really just the accumulation of what we've learned about how available other people are to us when we're freaking out, right? Like, yeah. How available are other people to us when I need somebody? And some of us learn, like, other people are pretty reliable. You know, in fact, about 60% of us learn other people are pretty reliable. Some of us learn when I really need other people, they're completely random. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not there. It has nothing to do with what's going on with me. And we learn, well, if other people aren't reliable, I really have to keep my eye on them, right? We start to develop a way of being in relationship that's very vigilant. Because I don't know if you're going to be there for me when I need you. So I need to keep an eye on you. And others of us learn that nobody really cares, right? Like if I really need somebody, I kind of have to rely on myself because my life has taught me when it hits the fan, nobody's really going to be there for me. And then unfortunately, some of us learn that when I really need others, they're exploitative, right? When I really need others, they're actually painful. And when we start to recognize, oh, one of the lessons that I learned is other people don't care. Then it opens up the possibility of purposely checking. Like my instinct's going to tell me that my partner doesn't care that I'm sad right now, but I want to form an intimate relationship with this. At least intellectually, it makes sense to me that it's something that I would want. So I'm going to have to practice saying something about it, like giving my partner the opportunity to show me whether or not they have the capacity to be there for me when I'm sad. And again, back to what we were talking about before, if they do meet that, then we know like, oh, you're different from my history. You're somebody that actually cares and is going to show up. And if they don't, then again, that's information that we get to use. But without having taken that risk and having to do it consciously, our instinct is always going to keep us a little bit turned away. And we're never really going to know what we and the people who love us are capable of.
Is there anything in the literature regarding big families versus like a couple kids? I'm the youngest of six boys.
Yeah.
And my sense of my own sort of relationship with my parents was like, there was just like, it was chaos.
They were overwhelmed.
You hide out in the family. Like, you know, we're all too busy. There's too much stuff going on. And my parents stayed together their whole lives. My dad and I was close with both of them, very close with my dad. And you know, intellectually aligned, politically aligned, culturally aligned, a lot of movies and plays and sports. We have two kids, we lost one, and that's a whole different kind of relationship than my experience of the big family. Anything there? Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess the thing that comes up for me is what we know about attachment figures, and that it doesn't necessarily have to be a parent.
Yeah.
Right. That really, you know, as long as there was somebody in your life who is the person that, you know, when we ask the question, when you were hurt, when you were sad, you know, the first time that you got your heart broken or a friend made fun of you, like who did you go to and mm-hmm. how did they react? Yeah. Right. And sometimes that's a parent. Sometimes that's a brother or a sister or a cousin or your aunt next door or a next door neighbor, you know, like, but in a, I would imagine in a big family, it might more likely be a sibling.
Yeah. Yep. I think it was. I think also there was just more options. Mm-hmm. So there was almost always someone there that you could grab, and especially when I'm the youngest, right? Mm-hmm. Especially, right. You know, that, so, and I didn't get beat up. Like, that wasn't the thing that happened in our family. Mm-hmm. But I had people who would intervene if someone else right. wanted to.
Yeah.
There's a line in the book that I put in bold in my notes, which is, quote, every single thing that we do matters, end quote. That is so largely true. But not something that I think we're comfortable with.
Oh God, 100%, right? Like,
yeah,
it's such an incredible ownership of opportunity to really step into how much responsibility we have, mm-hmm. right? That you know, we live in this world in a way that where we are, this is the paradox, right? Where we are both, where we're both cause and effect, right? Mm-hmm. Like how we show up in a particular moment really is in so many ways, just the accumulation of experiences that we've had up to that point. Mm-hmm. And in this a pinpoint moment, you know, the present moment, when we are conscious and clear and mindful, we get to make choices. And whether that we're making those choices consciously or not, everything that we do has an impact on the people around us. And it's on both sides of it, right? Like the things that you do and the things that you fail to do all matter. They all get added and nothing ever gets subtracted, right? And so that's part of, you know, I think when we make contact with that, we want to turn away from it because it feels like too much responsibility. But turning away from it doesn't change the truth of it. And I think in our intimate relationships, in our family relationships, in our friendships, when we really absorb that truth, that every word that comes out of my mouth is going to have an impact, like it's written in ink. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing gets to be erased. Everything that I should have said that I didn't say also gets recorded in ink. Right. And, you know, it sharpens that sense that we matter, that our interactions matter, that each moment needs to be treated with care and clarity. There are no throwaway moments, right? I didn't mean to say that. Mm-hmm. You know, the impact is what resonates, right? The intent vanishes, right? So again, this is for me a way to bring to mind the seriousness with which we need to be mindful in those. In every interaction that we have with whoever it is, right? Because we are impactful, whether we think we are or not.
I have a thought, which is one of the ways to ease the burden of understanding of these, every one of these things is important. It's all written in ink, is to approach these situations with play.
Mm.
And I think about this, the thing that came up in my mind is my wife and I love the Thin Man books and movies. We named our kids Nick and Nora. Our new puppy is named Asta. I mean, we're those people.
Okay,
those characters, I mean, Myrna Loy and William Powell, they are so playful with each other and they take all their faults and they have plenty of mutual faults and they play with them. They become part of the story that's funny and the banter. And I know I have diffused so many situations of the stupid crap I've said by owning it with play.
Yeah, no, I love that. That's such an insight. I think of it in two ways. One, that the safer we come to feel with each other, the more that we are comfortable with our own vulnerability, comfortable with my vulnerability in this relationship. Playfulness is like a very predictable side effect of that. The people that are the most comfortable with their vulnerability and most comfortable in relationship with each other are the most playful. And it's also, you know, there's something in the way that you tell the story that points at the lightness with which you carry yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is also, you know, the way, the light way in which we can just express that humility of, like, one of the things that I don't know if you do this as well, but sometimes the tone that I say something in is not necessarily the tone I intended. Right. And my partner and I have this very sort of like sweet and funny way of being like, was that the, and you're like, yep. No, that was, I heard that. She's like, did you hear that? I was like, yeah, no, I heard that. That was not the, I don't even know where that tone came from. Right.
Yeah.
So there is something that is, but it's a playfulness in that spot where, like, we know we're navigating inside this delicate space, but there's a gracefulness. There's a grace that we can bring to it because we're practiced in that space, right? And humor, I think, is one of the ways in which we signal both our caring and our that we intend no harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we work with the academic community a lot, mostly around improvisation. Though my wife Anne is a academic who also is a comedy academic, humor academic. And comedy is trickier. Humor is trickier because the line I always use is you shouldn't use it without a license because it's going to get you in trouble. It's the misuse of humor is just, you know, canceled more people than anything, I think.
Right.
But that's also because it's a superpower, you know, I wish, you know, I don't think I got enough years left on this planet to do this, but I wish it were something that we could build out for all humans because it is, what's that line? The shortest distance between two people is a laugh. It's incredibly important and I've seen this in literature, right? The sense of humor and all that, but it's not easy. And it takes time to learn it and then, you know, is the timing right? This is the other thing. What's the context of the room you're in? It's like, all comedy is not created equal across a variety of contexts. So it's hard enough for us to, like, right? To get it right. And so but we use it. Everyone uses it.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with this.
I think, you know, what's coming up for me is that why do people get canceled? Right. Because of it. Right. Because we are, when you're trying to be funny, to, you know, in front of other people, whether you're conscious of it or not, you're traveling together into vulnerable space.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, when the comedian's on stage, you know, probably one of the most vulnerable making things that one can do, I'm just going to come out here either by myself or with my friends. Right. And we're going to just start revealing things, right? But they're common things, right? The thing that makes it funny is that the audience recognizes it, right? And they're often things that are really intensely vulnerable.
All of them. Yes, it's what's wrong. Think of it. I do this all the time. Every Netflix special of your favorite comedians, they are revealing their thing. John Mulaney's a drunk. Amy Schumer's a slut. Patton Oswalt's a schlub. I could keep going forever.
Right, yeah.
But it is. It's what – and there's this very interesting Kurt Gray has a great book on the cultural divide that we're in. And he said the one thing that he has found that allows people to speak across difference. Hi, dog. The one thing that allows people to speak across difference is shared harm.
Mm.
And that's yeah. kind of what's going on there.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. And that's it. And so it makes sense. I love the line about you shouldn't operate without a license, right? Because you're inviting each other into that intimate, into that vulnerable space. And if it doesn't, you know, when it works, there's something in it that is the sweetness of the laugh, right? Mm-hmm. Is recognizing ourselves in each other. There's an acceptance in it, right? I think when there is more judgment in it, when there's more critique in it, and then that can tip into contempt, that's when people get hurt. And yep. then that's when people get canceled.
Yeah, exactly. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before sure. we do that, in chapter 9, that chapter is Burning Intimacy Bridges. You have a very short line, but I want you to tell us what you mean. You say, quote, "If we are lucky, it's our fault."
Yeah, so this has become more and more the soapbox that I get on in my work with couples, that our, you know, when we are stung, and stinging happens all the time, right? Especially in that vulnerable, when we're really inside a quill's distance, our instinct is either fight or flight. Yeah. And both of those show up in ways that are blaming of the other, right? So I'm hurt and it's your fault, and you need to do something about it. And then we fall into this stance that is incredibly passive, because I'm waiting for you to do something, and I'm just signaling in some often passive way that I'm hurt. And this idea that if you're lucky, it's your fault. It comes from an old Zen story about the chef was in a hurry because they were running late. And when he was out in the garden, he, unbeknownst to him, cut off the head of a snake and included it in the vegetables that went into what's supposed to be a vegetarian soup. Mm-hmm. And all of the monks were like, "This is the most delicious soup ever." And at some point, the master, the teacher, holds the snake head up in his chopsticks, right? And says, mm-hmm. "What's this?" Right? Like, this is a moment, right? Of like, you're in trouble. And the head cook just walks up and takes the snake's head in his own chopsticks and says, "Oh, there it is," and just pops it in his mouth and eats it, right? So it's mm-hmm. like eating the blame, right? And everybody mm-hmm. laughs because, you know, everybody knows what's happening, right?
Yeah.
And so that it's taking the reins of the moment, right? It's grabbing the steering wheels in the moment. And for me, this is a way of helping partners to recognize that you always have agency in the relationship. In every moment you have agency. If there is hurt, and even if you're the one that was hurt, there's something you can do. There's something that you may have done. There's something that you're failing to do in that moment. So if you're lucky, it's your fault, because then you can do something about it, right? Like, my partner said something and it hurt my feelings and now I'm turned away. If I'm lucky, it's my fault. What's my fault in this moment? I'm turned away. I can turn back, right?
Yeah,
and say, "Oh,
yeah.
Sweetie, that thing that you said really hurt my feelings," right? And I kind of need you to say sorry or whatever, right? And like, "Oh, shoot, I didn't even realize that that happened." And of course, we start with like excuse, excuse, excuse. And then hopefully we get to, "But you're right, I didn't mean that and I'm sorry," right? So it is a practice. It can be incredibly humbling. But when we can recognize that in every moment we have responsibility, you know, we have an ability to respond, then we become the stewards of our lives and the stewards of our relationships. And it's something that we are doing and we are cultivating, and not something that's just happening to us.
When I used to hire talent at Second City, so I did that from 92 to 2015. One of the things I learned to say to every new person who came in is, I'm like, "All right, so we're hiring you to Second City. Now it's your fault."
I love that.
And my point was, we're an institution that everyone complains about because it's the dream factory, and you know, whether you got the dream or didn't get the dream. But I'm like, but we are just all the people who make this up. So if you want to change something, it's now in your hands and my hands. It's all about, we're it. And I think it's stuck. And I think I forgot about it until I read that line. And I'm almost going to recommend that we return to it, because it is that sense of, I think one of the things that gets lost today, and maybe it was always something that was hard to grasp onto, it is that sense of like, hey, this is us. This is
right.
This is all of us. We're all doing this or not doing this. And
right.
And it only works if we all do it. You know,
right.
it's that, you know, when we play zero sum game, you know, there's a loser. So let's not.
Right. Right. Yeah, I love that. It's absolutely the same thing, right? It's that mm-hmm. invitation into like, you're responsible now for what happens here, right? And there is both an oh no quality to that and a oh good, right? Because then I get to have an influence, right? Like I'm not just waiting to see what happens. I'm not a passive recipient. I am one of the authors of what's happening here. And that's always true.
Yeah. You have a line in the book. You say we co-create each other.
Yeah.
And that's lovely. That's exactly it. All right.
Yeah.
We always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. You got one for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, right. You know, I've been an academic my whole life, right? So these are the seas that I swim in. And most of what I do is like, do research and write about research and get grants and do that sort of thing. I've been swimming in academic waters for my whole life. And there was a point, what is this, like 8 years ago now, where the provost of my university, Clark University here in Worcester, Massachusetts, came to me and said that, you know, we're looking for one of the faculty on campus to leverage their intellectual property and like start a startup company. And would you be interested in doing that? And what I know about business would fit in a thimble, right? Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is like, I've had a grant that I was working on. I had this whole trajectory, but one of my, I always make the joke that movie Yes Man is sort of about me, right? Mm-hmm. Like I just say yes mm-hmm. and then I figure it out. Right. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, it was completely non-academic. I probably, to the point of the question, should have just said no.
Yeah.
But I said, yeah, let's figure out how to do that. Right. Having absolutely no idea what I was doing. So we started.
What happened?
So we started this little startup company to disseminate the relationship checkup. Then it was called the marriage checkup, mm-hmm. which is the relationship health equivalent of your annual health checkup, your regular dental checkup. It's a way to change the way that we do relationship health from reactive tertiary care to preventative care. Mm-hmm. So we started this company. We named it Aramu, which is ancient Sumerian, we believe, at least according to a Google search, for love. Uh-huh. So Aramu means love. And I found, you know, like my closest colleague and talked her into doing it with me. And then we found a business guy to throw in with us to do that. This young Clarky, to be, you know, the one person that knew anything about business. And stumbled around failing for years. Mm-hmm. And then we were finally lucky enough to secure some grants with the Office of the Secretary of Defense to train all of the military family life counselors around the world to do relationship checkups, which really just like solidified the company. So now we're like, oh, we actually are a company. We're not just the idea of a company. And we've just had a lot of success recently in training providers to do regular relationship checkups and to being able to provide regular relationship checkups to couples who want to take good and regular care of their relationship health. So as it turns out, I don't suck at business. Right. Who knew?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that. The book is called The Mindful Path to Intimacy, Cultivating a Deeper Connection with Your Partner. James Cordova, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It was wonderful.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.